your brother Vladimir Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition.
The report of the downturn of the pandemic economy has hit many Americans hard. And for a number of millennials born between 1981 and 1996 and Generation Z who follow them, that pain plus a number of other factors are leading some to ask, who is responsible? Over the next couple of nights, economics correspondent Paul Solman is going to examine this generational tension, beginning tonight from the perspective of some millennials.
Baby boomers, greatest generation, got all the money, now we got the vaccination.
On Saturday Night Live this season, an OK Boomer takedown.
Got a job out of college, no student debt, retirement funded 100%.
It just sort of encapsulates this sort of whole sense of unfairness, where it's always the boomers first and their kids last.
Bruce Gibney, author of A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America, says vaccinating the elderly first made perfect sense from a public health standpoint.
The challenge is that after years of abusive behavior on the part of the boomers, this might be the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Gibney says the pandemic has fueled a growing resentment of baby boomers, which he marks a bit earlier, those of us born between 1940 and 65, rather than just after the war. It's a resentment among millennials, 1981 to 1996, whose economic prospects have supposedly been sacrificed to help greedy, ungrateful boomers, oblivious to the realities facing the young.
The millennials in Generation Z have the Peter Pan syndrome. They don't ever want to grow up.
This 2019 TikTok video helped popularize the phrase, okay, boomer, as a retort to the boomer critique.
You're going to mature and you're going to realize nothing's free, that things aren't equal, and that your utopian society you created in your mind in your youth simply is not sustainable.
How do real-life millennials respond?
Very offended, because I am a very hard worker.
All we want to do is sit around, watch Netflix, or play video games.
Like, based on everyone I know and even myself, I'm not sure where that notion comes from.
The biggest thing is, like, we want their things. Like, we want their house and we want their bank account.
A boomer myself, by Gibney's broader definition, since I was born in 1944, I asked four millennials for their take. 37-year-old Travis Barker lives outside of Denver, Colorado, was laid off during the pandemic. In Gilroy, California, 29-year-old Sonia Reyes, daughter of Mexican immigrants and mother of two, put herself through college, only recently saved enough to move out of her parents' home. Brianna Nicholas, 28, an accountant in Philadelphia, has $200,000 in student debt for her degree in historic preservation. And 34-year-old Joe Caputo in Oklahoma City worked odd jobs for years. All college grads heading toward middle age, scraping by.
You know, I have a four-year degree. I have, honorably discharged in the military. I've worked overseas. I've never been arrested. I've never failed a class. And yet I still feel like I'm behind the eight ball. There's no doubt that you guys had it easier than we do.
Like Travis said, no matter what you actually accomplish or feel like you accomplish, you don't feel like you're actually moving forward in life. It's like you don't feel like you can actually become a full adult.
We had to move from San Jose to Gilroy because San Jose was just too expensive.
But you're a two-income family, right? You can't afford even to buy a house in Gilroy?
No, the houses in Gilroy are a bit cheaper than San Jose, but not to like to the point where I by myself and my husband can afford a house.
Renting is basically all I kind of see for my wife and I. for the foreseeable future, just because we can budget for it.
Okay, we bought houses when they were way cheaper. But does that make us sociopaths?
The most important thing about sociopaths is that they don't have a great sense of obligations to others.
For Bruce Gibney, writer, jackpot winner as an early investor in PayPal and Facebook, the economic anxieties of millennials are the result of decades of sociopathic choices by boomers who grew up in a booming America.
They had an enormous tailwind, and they decided to set a direction that really only benefited themselves.
They, you mean me, right? You mean me and my friends?
I do.
Every stretch of farm and factory to market road earns profits for all the nation.
Gibney says we boomers benefited from investments in roads, new schools, education, paid for with taxes on previous generations. But when it was the boomers' turn to give, we continued to take. Tax cuts, expanded Medicare and Social Security, an imbalance that led to an explosion of debt. Gibney points out that when he was born in 1976, the national debt was about a third the size of the annual economy. After decades of boomers at the helm, he says, it's now some 130%. And while millennials are the largest portion of the workforce, the Federal Reserve just reported they have less than 5% of the country's wealth. The boomers, meanwhile, had four times that percentage at around the same age.
Do you blame my generation for the difficulty that the millennials, for example, are now having? High college costs, high student debt, can't afford a house, and so forth.
I do, to a large degree. And we see it in the explosion of student debt, which the government didn't even keep records on in the early 1960s because it wasn't economically significant. Today, it's $1.7 trillion. The schools were in excellent shape when the boomers came of age. They are in appalling shape now, worse in the aggregate even than our roads and bridges. That is astonishing levels of political neglect. Nothing has been done with respect at a serious level regarding the environment. And it's not as if the boomers didn't know that these were going to be problems.
Did the millennial panel agree that the policies that we put in place or just allowed to happen are what have put you at such a disadvantage?
That's certainly how it feels to me.
After 30, 40 years, you look back on the policies and you see, you know, the income gap, you know, your purchasing power, and the cost of education and housing has gone way up compared to wages. And, you know, once you look back on that and you still don't acknowledge your part in that, yeah, that's when it kind of becomes hard to understand how they justify that.
Well, they is me, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you. How do you justify that? No. You know, individually, these people, I don't think are sociopaths, like you referenced that book. But on a policy level, absolutely are. It's hard to describe you guys as anything other than that.
Brianna Nicholas had a less clinical diagnosis.
Boomer is kind of like a filler word for status quo. Like, it's not the generation itself. It's just the fact that, like, the unwillingness to understand that things have changed, things are changing, and kind of keep it the way it is because it worked for them, assuming that it'll work for everyone else, and that's just not true.
But wait a minute. What about the 60s, when boomers worldwide were coming of age and pushing back against previous generations for civil rights, feminism, gay rights? Don't we get credit for that?
No, and if you look at the chronology, you can see that this is just true. Desegregation of schools, Brown versus Board of Education, 1954. Average boomer is 2, pretty sure they're not in the Supreme Court. Civil Rights Act of 1964, average median boomer is 12. Again, not a constituency, not in power. Voting Rights Act of 1965, again, not a constituency, not in power. Median boomer is 13, and so on down the lines.
And the legion of boomers who started Earth Day, voted against the tax cuts, carried the flag for social change?
Yes, I agree that while boomers are, as individuals, good and bad, just like any other generation, any other group of people, as a political generation, they have systematically favored policies that have benefited themselves at the expense of others.
So what now? Any hope for the millennials? Well, we're going to pass on. And as I pointed out to the panel, the amount of money that boomers have made and saved will go to you all, right?
It's a little morbid to have to wait for your relatives to die to have some side, like, kind of financial success.
I should be able, with my career, with my husband's career, you know, be able to save enough money to have financial security plus living in an adequate home.
And who's to argue that she shouldn't be? Well, in our next story, we'll hear the somewhat surprising response from boomers themselves.
I want to apologize because I don't feel we're leaving a better world for them.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Paul Solomon, born in 1944.
Now have some degree of protection.
States in getting vaccines into their older population.
The majority of baby boomers have been vaccinated. Have been vaccinated. Have been vaccinated. 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 Vaccinated.
Baby boomers, greatest generation. Got all the money, now we got the vaccination. Crash the economy three whole times. But when it comes to the vax, we the first in line.
Got a job out of college, no student debt. Retirement funded 100%. Voted for Trump, but just for the taxes. Don't believe in COVID, still got the vaccine.
Pfizer, Moderna, I know you earn. Get one, but you gotta wait your turn. I get to the vax, I get what I want, son. You get what's left, bitch.
Johnson & Johnson.
Money stacks. Hands,
cats,
arm,
vax,
no mask.
Biggest generation, ain't no stopping me. Never gonna die, drain your social security.
The boomers got the vax. No rumors, just facts, yeah. Give it up if you're 70 plus. Everyone else getting jealous of us, jealous of us.
Baby boomer.
Ow! COVID can't touch me now. Low mask and a sore nose poking out. When it's time to pay, I whip the coupons out. Even though I got to send me in the bank account.
Y'all can't say, let me give you a clear sense. We out here spending your inheritance. You in the parking lot eating by the trash, right? We in the booth reading menus with the flashlight. Yeah, I know you missed us. Might book a trip on the Diamond Princess. Eat all the food, drink all the booze, sail all the cruise while you're still off the Zoom.
Job, retired,
climate,
deny it,
license,
expired,
but we still on fire.
Stop by my house, give my grandkids a hug. Now get the f*** out, I'm trying to have fun.
The boomers got the vax, everyone else gets in the back. Yeah, we coming first like we always do. We're jumping in front of you and you and you and you and you.
I am M-U-N-I-T-Y, that's what I got, body's anti, I got the shot, that's just how it is, you locked inside, homeschooling my grandkids, I know you wanna live large like me, I got the big ass house and the SUV, I got the second house two, and the third house three, and the place in Vermont, and one in Miami, damn, I got five houses, that's a lot, good for me.
Hit the lease with the drinks for another golf sesh. You on the Vax website hitting the refresh. You whine and cry while we dine inside. We run the world since 1945. Ha!
Me, I spend my time playing tennis. Two things that don't work, me and my penis.
My shirt,
what about her? You know it's getting tough. And my wife,
what about her?
She left me.
Oh.
Hold up, I ain't had my say yet. Yo, tell them what my name is.
Edith.
On the track, you know I'm backs out. Papa C. Alice, come throw your back out. Hands in the air like your shoulder don't hurt. Drop that ass to the floor like your knees still work.
Boomers got the vax. Boomers got the vax.
It is what it is, sucker.
It was a fairly quiet, fairly conformist period. And the parents in that period were living out a kind of idealized life that for many of them they had kind of postponed through some rather tough times. The Depression, obviously World War II. So you came out of World War II and the Depression with a desire to get back to kind of a normal existence. There was a kind of celebration of family. A celebration of an embracing of a suburban life. And so I think those kind of desires, a desire to kind of put the turbulence of the 30s and 40s, early 40s anyway, behind them and get back to kind of a normal existence, really did shape the childhoods of a lot of white middle class kids anyway. You know, so there was this celebration of family. I mean, this was an extraordinary baby boom. you know, and an inordinate a number of kids born during a fairly short range of years. Again, as part of it is because adults put off having children because the depression would not allow them or did not provide them with the financial resources to start a family. Many men were off doing, you know, in World War II, serving in the military. So you have a fairly large number of people all launching families at roughly the same time, and you did produce an enormous demographic explosion. And that fundamentally changed the relationship between generations in a way that was profoundly important in the development of this thing we called the 60s. I mean, normally young people aspire to grow up to be adults because that's where the center of cultural and political attention is. Well, for these kids, very early on, it was square on them. They were the center of everything. And I remember, I'm a late baby boomer, a relatively late baby boomer, but I remember with delighted shock looking at Life magazine in something like 62 or 63 and going, and there was a long, serious pictorial essay on the makeout party, the California makeout party. And I went, my God, it's my life. My life is important. And from that moment on, I felt as if I was, or at least people like me, my peers and myself, were the center of political and generational and social and cultural attention in this country. That fundamentally changes relations between the generations and makes a very distinctive experience. This generation was kind of imbued with a sense of potency very early on. We can be different. Life as we've known it in the past can change. I really think they had very few horizons, or rather very few constraints on what they could imagine the horizon to be. There was this kind of sense of invulnerability. These were idyllic times in a certain sense, and they were also enormous a period of prosperity. So that with the kind of cultural spotlight squarely on them and with seemingly unlimited opportunities, they could dare to do things and conceive of themselves and conceive of their life opportunities in ways that other generations simply hadn't been able to. If you were a kid growing up in the late 20s, early 30s, you were forced by circumstances, certainly, to limit your horizons rather dramatically. I suspect that's true in World War II as well. These kids seemingly had the world laid out before them. And I think that is a set of mixed messages. Yes, they're kind of conformist, be proper, we want you to succeed in rather conventional ways. But you're the center of attention, we want the absolute best for you, dream big, aspire big, reach out. I mean, it was a perfect setting in which the youth culture, in a certain sense, could blossom. Life in the suburbs was organized around the kids again. They were the center of attention, an endless round of Little League games and PTA meetings, etc. So it was in the suburbs, in a certain sense, that this message about the importance and the uniqueness and the generational potency associated with these kids, I think, was delivered with real force. So I suspect that's how it was experienced. At some point, but that's much later, they come to view it in rather critical terms as being insular and constraining and confining. But at that point in time, I suspect it was simply experienced as a world in which I'm surrounded by my kind of people and I'm being celebrated and my life is being, and I'm being told my life is very significant. The split begins to occur, I would say, because other perspectives on this way of life and on the insular world in which these kids have been embedded start to seep in, start to creep into the fabric of their existences. I don't think one can underestimate the importance of the civil rights movement. I'll put it baldly, I don't think there would have been any 60s, whatever that was, without the civil rights movement. I mean, again, when we think of the 60s stereotypically, I think we think of the white middle class experience of the 60s, but it has its roots squarely in the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement probably most forcefully began to let kids and others in society know that all was not so rosy in this idealized American landscape. That there were really things called race. There was things like racism and discrimination and poverty and brutality and oppression that simply didn't accord with the idealized way of life that was supposedly being played out in the suburbs. That's certainly not the only influence, but that's a very powerful one. You know, again, we think of the 50s as quiescent and peaceful and complacent and conformist, but these kids, or certainly their parents, would click on the tube and would see played out nightly scenes of real violence in their country, which they had been taught was such a wonderful, humane place. I mean, I was talking with an individual who had been active in the civil rights movement, a white volunteer, and that person said, you know, we're depicted as this kind of angry generation, but no one ever seems, as if we grew up angry. Well, no one seems to ask, where did the anger come from? Well, a lot of it comes from this gap between this idealized image of America that we were taught to believe in, and then the reality of American life, the not so pleasant realities of American life that didn't accord with that idealism. The idealism that we were raised to believe in, contradicted as it was by these more unseemly events in American society, fueled the anger. I think the economic factor, the factors in the 50s, is arguably the key piece of the whole puzzle. This was a period of unprecedented national prosperity. You came out of the war years, and two things really fueled the prosperity. One was the Cold War, ironically. You know, you still had massive defense spending to counter the threat of communist expansion all over the globe. But beyond that, you also had parents producing large numbers of children. And that created an enormous market for all manner of goods and services. So the money kind of flowing through the system all through the late 40s, through the 50s, well into the 60s, allowed for a kind of indulgence and a kind of unlimited horizons and a sense of the possible that all generations don't experience. And that was a profoundly important part of this whole story.
Now we continue our look at generational tensions in our country over economic disparities. The COVID-19 shutdown and recession may have exacerbated an already growing division in popular culture between millennials and baby boomers. Tonight we hear from that older generation and from our own economics correspondent, Paul Salmon.
No matter what you actually accomplish or feel like you accomplish, you don't feel like you're actually moving forward in life. It's like
the millennials' lament. We heard it last night from a group of millennials.
2020 came, still had no income. So we were living with my parents.
I still feel like I'm behind the eight ball.
And the pandemic has only made economic matters worse, even for our group of college grads, a group hit much less hard than those without higher degrees.
Renting is basically all I kind of see for my wife and I for the foreseeable future.
This one goes out to all the 65 plus Brad on SoundCloud.
So who to blame? More and more these days, it's okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer. Okay, boomer. Okay, boomer. Okay, boomer.
That is, the baby boom, roughly those of us born between the end of World War II and 1964, is fingered as the culprit. So tonight, we give my generation the right of reply.
Beating up on baby boomers, it's sort of the last acceptable prejudice.
Professor Lenny Steinhorn wrote The Greater Generation in Defense of the Baby Boom Legacy 15 years ago, when blame was already being assigned.
You know, you see all of these essays and all of these articles and all of these people going on TV criticizing baby boomers as if they're somehow singularly selfish or narcissistic or the me generation and all of that. And so I wanted to be able to correct the record, correct the history, and put it in historical context.
Part of the context, says Steinhorn, 65, is pure luck, growing up in a booming economy, as a group of boomer panelists we assembled happily did. Like Joe Ferreira, 56, a high school history teacher in Massachusetts.
When I left school, I had no debt on my shoulders. And the total amount after my second graduate degree that I had in debt was literally a $1,000 personal loan.
Bert Fohr was a classmate of mine at Brandeis University, became a lawyer, founded the American Antitrust Institute.
When it came time to get jobs in college, the government was hiring and there were jobs in the government. And we had that advantage because of a growing economy, a booming economy, if you will.
Norma McKay from the Chicago suburbs, a retired software engineer.
I have five job offers without me doing any bit of work. I got offers from IBM, Bell Laboratories, Rockwell International, Sun Microsystems. I got to reject IBM. That was really something.
Allison Adderley, a 62-year-old community college professor in Orlando, Florida.
I bought my first house when I was 24.
How much did it cost?
$51,000.
That home has about tripled in value. By contrast,
you have to lower your expectation. It's not viable.
When we were their age, there was less inequality, homes were cheaper, the middle class stronger, taxes on the wealthy higher. Climate, outsourcing, offshoring, no issue. So did our panelists feel guilty about what's happened on our watch?
I want to apologize because I don't feel we're leaving a better world for them. I guess we shoulder all the blame, right? Because we're the people that were in charge.
I feel somewhat guilty, like we dropped the ball.
The other half of the panel, however, disagreed.
I don't feel guilty because I believe that it was just circumstance that put us at that time period. I do feel responsible. I don't feel guilty.
I don't buy this generational guilt at all. I think that we were lucky. We were on a ladder that was going up with no help from us. The ladder meant that assets were increasing in value in ways that they are not today.
So you don't feel guilty about the tax cuts, the offshoring, the things that you think have put millennials at a disadvantage?
I've probably opposed all of those things during the last 40 years. So I don't feel guilty about it. I feel frustrated. I wanted to leave a better world for my kids and grandkids.
But boomers voted for the folks who pushed these policies, no?
Politically, you have a very diverse country, and people vote for any number of reasons at that particular point in time.
In fact, since the 1980s, boomers have by and large split about evenly in presidential elections. So about half of us voted for tax cuts and freer markets, half not. Half our panel feels guilty, half not. And look, says Steinhorn,
economic change is often beyond the control of a generation because you're living through it. You're managing, you're trying to raise a family, you're trying to sort of support yourself. You're trying to put a roof over your head and food on the table and have a meaningful, if you can, livelihood in that matter.
Instead of feeling guilty, he argues that baby boomers have plenty to be proud of.
Fundamentally, the baby boom generation took on the outdated norms of the generation before and began to transform America.
Sure, the greatest generation survived the Depression, helped win World War II, but that's not their whole legacy, says Steinhorn.
They were the ones who chose to move into the Levittowns and exclude black people from those suburbs, who continued to deny the rights of women, to, you know, force gay people to go through implosive therapy or electroshock therapy because they didn't fit in. So the baby boom generation saw that and fundamentally changed it.
Civil rights, feminism, LGBTQ, and disability rights. No panelist felt guilty about this history.
I am very proud. Yeah, you know, demonstrations on campus, peaceful demonstrations. I was there every day at lunchtime.
We may not have brought it to complete fruition, but we started a lot of it. I, as a baby boomer, I'm going to take some credit for that as I take some blame for the other stuff as well.
But what about the existential threat that millennials will face after we're long gone? Global warming.
Under baby boomers' watch, did this happen? Sure, but this is something that's been going on for 175 years since the dawn of the industrial era, and we are really fully realizing the consequences of all of that now. So to say that one generation is responsible for that, that's ahistorical.
And please don't forget, says Steinhorn,
it was the baby boom generation that basically motivated Earth Day and jump-started the environmental movement.
So then how valid is it to generalize about one generation at all?
You have to look at history as a far more complex phenomenon than the sort of generational divide that is really artificial is framing right now. So why are we pitting a generation against each other when in fact all they're basically doing is pointing a finger at baby boomers for a few bad mistakes that took place during those years, not recognizing how society has transformed since the 1950s in fundamental, deep, institutional, personal, interpersonal ways.
Bert Fuhr agreed.
you can't blame one generation, because one generation never has power, at least not for much time.
Allison Adderley?
I agree. You cannot group any, whole group of people together and say that they all think alike.
But as a member of the generation that popularized the phrase, don't trust anyone over 30, there is one part of the millennial critique that Steinhorn applauds.
I think okay boomer is a great phrase. I think every younger generation should stick their thumb in the eye of their elders and poke them and prod them and basically say, okay, stop giving us your wisdom and stop telling us what to do. It's our turn now and we're going to do it.
Handing off the baton with some relief then. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solomon.
Hello and welcome to All Generations. Today we're talking about the Silent Generation. I feel the Silent Generation is less known and talked about because it is a smaller, older, and possibly more silent generation. Did you know some of them were born before the chocolate chip cookie was invented? Yum. So let's learn about this lesser known generation. I'll be covering lots of topics. If you want to check out a specific topic, then you can click one of the timestamps down below. If not, it'd be cool if you watch the whole video. Regardless, on this channel, I cover different topics relating to the generations and over time topics. So if you're interested in stuff like that, feel free to subscribe and hit the bell to get notifications. So let's get to it. What is the Silent Generation? The Silent Generation is a generation between the Greatest Generation and the Baby Boomers. So why silent? People began using the term Silent Generation in the late 1940s and early 1950s. FYI, I'm about to hit you with a bunch of quotes in this section. A 1951 Time article called People, the Younger Generation, said, "The most startling fact about the younger generation is its silence. With some rare exceptions, youth is nowhere near the rostrum. By comparison with the flaming youth of their fathers and mothers, today's generation is a still small flame. It does not issue manifestos, make speeches, or carry posters. It has been called the Silent Generation." A couple years earlier is when we first saw the idea of this Silent Generation. In 1949, Fortune magazine came out with a story on the college class of 1949 called Taking No Chances. It described the class as so tractable and harmonious as to be incapable 20 or 30 years hence of making provocative decisions, and also criticized them for taking no chances and having a gray flannel mentality. Basically, they were saying the generation was afraid to speak up or take risks and preferred to simply blend in. It does seem like a bit of a contrast to how we think of people today, and allegedly a contrast to their parents and seemingly children as well. I do need to know some things though. The Fortune magazine story was referring to those graduating college in 1949. With a normal 4 years in college, that would have put them probably born in 1926, 1927. Sometimes those people fall into the Greatest Generation, depends on which years you use. Anyone who took longer than those 4 years would have also been possibly and probably, depending on the years you use, in the Greatest Generation. And I would guess that there are more members that would have been in the generation just because of that timing. This is, 4 years after World War II ended, which is when some people would have came back, and some of those people may have gone to college and they could have been starting at a variety of ages. And so I just think that's good to keep in mind, that really what they are talking about here is sort of late Greatest, early Silent cusp area. It's still where we get the name from though. Another obvious idea you can garner from this is that someone always wants to criticize either the young people or just the generations they perceive as different from their own. In this case, maybe it's not as bad as others. Anyway, after those pieces came out, more people took a hold of this idea. In the 1950s, historian William Manchester, a member of the Previous Generation, described the young people as withdrawn, cautious, unimaginative, indifferent, unadventurous, silent. And it seems even some people who claim membership to the generation agree. In a 1970 Time essay, The Silent Generation Revisited, the author says, "We were, with a few exceptions, still quiet and serenely uninvolved." Note that I think the person who wrote that was also in that cusp area. Now, when you see anything talking about silent generation characteristics, including, the silent generation as we know them today, most of them do tend to describe them in the same manner. Cautious, playing by the rules, afraid to rock the boat. They're also thought to be civic-minded, traditional, and hardworking. They tend to be thrifty, and apparently like to appreciate the little things. Now, before I get into why some members at least may have been silent, let's address the fact that not all of them were, obviously. Not everyone fits the stereotypes of their generation. Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, and Gloria Steinem are all silents who made waves. Also, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a silent. The people who put together Woodstock were silents. And maybe some silents you know aren't so silent either. Let me know if you think the stereotype is correct or not, whether you're a silent or if you know one. So, for those who were silent, where did the silence and cautiousness come from? It could be a few things. During their childhood, the prominent mentality was that children were to be seen, not heard. Especially if adults were around, children were to keep quiet and know their place. An example, in some households, adults would eat dinner first. Obedience was more important than curiosity.
What is it?
Just eat it. This idea may have carried through with them later in life, where they might have been afraid to question authority. Of course, it also probably worked well for them in the hierarchical structures they would find in the workplace. Still, basically all of this would have been true of the Greatest Generation as well, and to a lesser extent, people that came after them. So let's look at some other possible factors. Going in a different direction, one reason they may be perceived as silent is because they're a smaller generation. There are less of them. This is similar to what we see with Gen X, where they're sandwiched between two bigger generations, and they can get lost in the mix because of the overpowering, like boomers, for example. And they're actually smaller than Gen X because during the Great Depression and World War II, people weren't really wanting to have a lot of kids. Which, speaking of, some people cite simply being children of the Great Depression and World War II as reasons for their disposition. Growing up in a time of instability could certainly contribute to them being afraid to rock the boat and jeopardize their success, which they did end up having, but I'll get to that later. In the US, growing up or coming of age during McCarthyism / the Second Red Scare is also commonly cited as a reason they are silent. For those who aren't familiar with the term, I'll try and explain it a little more in a bit, but first the Merriam-Webster definition. A mid-20th century political attitude characterized chiefly by opposition to elements held to be subversive and by the use of tactics involving personal attacks on individuals by means of widely publicized indiscriminate allegations, especially on the basis of unsubstantiated charges. Broadly, defamation of character or reputation through such tactics. The word McCarthyism originates with Senator Joseph McCarthy, who basically went around everywhere looking for communists and accusing people of being communists.
Now, sweetie, share the cookie with your brother.
That grandma's a communist. Lock her up. What? So this was going on, and yes, that was a bit of an exaggeration, or at least I hope it was, in the late 1940s and through the 50s. So during this time, silence would have been ranging from young children to their early 30s, so many were coming of age during this time. Before I get into more about them, I just want to touch on what birthiers people typically include as a silent generation birthiers. As always, well, usually it depends on where you look. I'm just going to hit on a few. Pew uses 1928 to 1945. Alan Strauss used 1925 to 1942. Australia's McCrindle Research says 1925 to 1945. British think tank The Resolution Foundation uses 1926 to 1945. And I've also seen plenty more, including just like before 1945, for those who don't want to look at generations before the silent generation. I'm torn myself. On the one hand, I like to just use pew years to make things simpler and be consistent. But on the other hand, it seems like a lot of the other sources start the years earlier. Plus, a lot of the original ideas around the silence actually are being applied to people who were born in those earlier years. One reason I do still like the 1928 year, though, is it makes it more so it was just the greatest generation / the GI generation serving in World War II, and that if someone from the silent was serving in it, it would have been because they were falsifying their age. So it would have made it so just those who were 18 and older. A personal example, my grandfather's brother, my great uncle, served in World War II. He was born in 1926. He technically did join at 17. That was the year he turned 18. And it was a year before the war ended, so you see how this happens. So the other would make it simpler. And speaking of him, he was fortunate enough age to serve in Korean War and Vietnam as well. Now let's talk about some of the events the silent generation would have experienced in early life to young adulthood-ish. Starting with the Great Depression. Few silents would have been born before the Great Depression started, and quite a few weren't born until after it ended, but that doesn't mean it didn't have an impact. History.com says, the Great Depression was the worst economic downturn in the history of the industrial world, lasting from 1929 to 1939. Fun fact, my great-grandma, an early silent, was born on October 28th, 1929, the day before Black Tuesday, which is the day the stock market crashed. She tells me about only eating broth and occasionally bread for a lot of her childhood. Now, while some silents weren't alive during this period, their parents were and would probably have gotten some cautiousness, necessary thriftiness, and probably a strong work ethic that they would then pass on to them. The Dust Bowl was an event that was around the same time. It was an environmental disaster, which caused hundreds of thousands of Americans and Canadians living in the prairies to flee to other areas. In the US, that was mostly California. You had a lot of Oklahomans going to California. But with the Great Depression going on, still few found better conditions. And the Dust Bowl ended as the Great Depression did. So obviously, this is when World War II began. And before you say the silence had it rough, yes, but remember that their parents, the Greatest Generation, were also kids or adults during the Great Depression, and then they were old enough to be drafted into World War II. Plus, some
Silence hadn't even been born at the start of the war. Even though I don't want to heavily cover events that some of the generation wouldn't have experienced, some of these events are so big they provide context for the time they were alive in. Some may have lost family members in that war or subsequent wars. This was also obviously the time of the Holocaust. An example of another silent you may know from this time is Anne Frank. She went into hiding in 1942 at the age of 13. On that note, I should probably also mention the Japanese internment camps in the US, which were going on around the same time. In 1945, the world's first atomic bomb dropped. The first nuclear explosion actually occurred earlier that year as well in a place I ended up living 50 years later. And guys, this stuff is bad for your health. Anyway, this was also sort of the start of the arms race with the Soviet Union. After the war, the baby boomers started being born, and there are a lot of other various things that happened due to the war ending, including the Philippines becoming independent, just as an example. In 1947, the Cold War between the Western and Eastern blocs began. Silents were aged around 2 to late teens or early 20s, depending on the year you use. Many of the major world events from now on are at the broader level, kind of between the US and the Soviet Union slash the USSR, and this was a battle with their ideologies, their power, including their weapons, military, as well as their achievements. The domino theory was influential at this time. That's the idea that if one country becomes communist, that others in the region will follow, like a domino. This is when the US saw the second Red Scare slash McCarthyism, which we talked about earlier in the Why the Silent Generation is Silent section. Now in 1949, the Soviet Union tested an atomic bomb themselves. In 1950, the Korean War began. I'm just going to say that some silents would have served in this war. Some of them would have been old enough to serve, though others were still children. It lasted until 1953, and the events leading up to this and the outcome of the war obviously shaped the countries today. On October 4th, 1957, the world's first artificial satellite, Sputnik, launched. This was a pretty big deal, not just because of the technology, but also because of the rivalry I mentioned earlier. The space race was on, and this was the beginning of the space age. When Soviet Union got Sputnik out, Eisenhower was like, "I am creating the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, otherwise known as NASA, immediately." And you know the rest. Space exploration of any kind was huge and very new, so it would have been super exciting to everyone watching. The 1950s were a key time for the silence as a whole, with ages ranging between 5 and early 30s over the decade. And so far we've discussed there's the Cold War, the Korean War, the launch of Sputnik, the space race, but there was more. 1955 was the start of the Vietnam War, though the US wasn't immediately involved. By the time the US was in Vietnam in the mid-60s, all silents would have been adults, and at this point, so were early boomers. Over 2 million were drafted. Some protested involvement, especially on college campuses, and that would have been a mix of late silents, early boomers, and in fact, that's also probably a lot of the mix of who was serving as well. The way the draft worked actually changed during this time, though, so it just depends on what period. When the Vietnam veterans returned, many did not feel a warm welcome and instead felt they were returning to a country that was torn apart. It was the aftermath of the Vietnam War that caused Congress to create the Vet Center program and recognize post-traumatic stress disorder, also known as PTSD. Now, going back to the 50s, this was also the time of the civil rights movement in the US. Brown versus Board of Education declared segregation of public schools illegal in 1954. The Montgomery bus boycott was the following year. The March on Washington was in 1963. So we're moving into the 60s now as well, of course. This is when MLK gave his I Have a Dream speech. Then there was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, outlawing discrimination based on sex, race, color, religion, or national origin. Well, in 1966, Cesar Chavez did his Long March in California, and there was more. White flight. And this is a migration of white people who were in areas that were becoming more ethnically and racially diverse. And that was in the 1950s and 60s. Often it meant moving from the cities to the suburbs. Jumping to the 60s more, again, when the silence were around 15 to the early 40s, 1960 was the JFK versus Nixon election. Most, but not all, silents were eligible to vote. I'm mentioning this because it was a close election in terms of the popular vote. JFK, who won, was America's first Catholic president, which apparently was a cause of concern for some. He was also one of the youngest presidents. 1961 was the year the Berlin Wall went up and the Bay of Pigs invasion occurred. The Cuban Missile Crisis was in 1962.
This is yet another U.S. Soviet Union Cold War thing. Then we have the JFK and MLK assassinations. And if silence are still perceived as silent today, maybe one could argue that seeing those assassinations could have impacted them as well. Also during this time, second wave feminism began. And we had the start of the gay rights movement in the U.S. with Stonewall occurring in the late 1960s, but we're really getting into boomer territory now. Now let's touch on some other technological and other life changes for the silent generation, both compared to the previous generations and during their life. The silent generation grew up in a time before microwaves were in households and before copiers were in offices, or at least before they were common. When the youngest silents were born, the Slinky was newly on the market, and Velcro was decades from being widely used. Scotch tape was new. The instant camera came out, but wasn't yet popular, and Monopoly made its debut in 1935. This generation experienced some big changes. While they had already been around, phones were becoming more common. My great-grandma, the 1929 one, told me that when she was a kid, so I guess probably in the 1930s or 40s, the first telephone came to town. And she said people would come from all over town to check it out, and she would climb something and watch them. Not sure what was going on. Radio was a big part of life for many in the 1930s, and they would sit around the radio listening to stories. Onto cars / automobiles, this is a big topic. When the first silents were born, automobiles had only recently become more common, and traffic lights were pretty new and not very widespread. The car / automobile changed a lot in society, and the car itself also changed a lot over time. But in general, it gave people more freedom, including young people, in areas like dating. Teenagers gained a big interest and the freedom that was allowed by cars. By the 1950s, washing machines and frozen food were becoming more common. The television introduced another huge change to life. While it was invented earlier, the TV wasn't initially marketed to consumers and didn't become popular in homes until the 1950s, when the youngest silents were in school and the oldest were in their 20s or maybe early 30s by the end of the 50s. The number of American households with a television went up significantly from 1950 to 1960. Earliest silents would have gone through most of their childhood and possibly all of it without a TV. The number of TV stations also went up. Popular shows included things like I Love Lucy, Leave It to Beaver, and The Twilight Zone. Can you imagine life before all the screens we have now? No TVs, no computers, no cell phones. That was life for many silents growing up. Cake mixes hit the shelf in the late 1940s and so became more common in the 50s. The late 1950s saw more inventions ranging from the microchip to Barbie, if you can call that an invention. In the early 60s, the first cassettes came out. Dishwasher was also out but didn't become popular until later when the silents were all in adulthood. So that was our earlier life. How has the silent generation adapted to the more recent technology of today? In 2019, Pew found that only 40% of silents aged 74 to 91 at the time owned smartphones, compared to 93% of millennials, 90% of Xers, and 68% of boomers. The older members may have trouble seeing the small numbers and letters, and some of them may be in homes. At the same time, that 40% number was up 10% from the previous year, so it looks like they're really getting on to adopting these technologies. In the same year, 2019, nearly a third owned a tablet computer, and 28% reported that they use social media, and both of those were on the upward swing as well. Fun fact, while they had assistants, I have Zoomed multiple relatives in their 90s, too.
Anyway, So far, I got $24 in quarters.
So that is pretty cool. Now, moving on to some other topics. Family and relationships. Typically, the parents of the silent generation were the greatest/TI generation. Marriage and children came early for both of these generations. Plus, that was a longer generation, so it just makes sense. But some, of course, could have come from before. The parents of the silent generation would have experienced both the Roaring 20s and then also the Great Depression, World War II. And many would have struggled to provide for their children following the economic crisis. So as was the case with their parents, it was normal for the silents to marry and have children early, with most of them marrying around their early 20s, some of them before that. Thus, dating in high school could be considered pretty serious. This is one reason the silents are also called traditionalists. They were following the footsteps of their parents, hitting these milestones early, and in some cases earlier than their parents. For their children, silents would generally have given birth to a mix of boomers and Xers. So obviously, if they were among the first silents and had kids early, it could have been another silent, or if they are on the later end, they could have given birth to early millennials. On to education. When silents were 25 to 37, 30% had not completed high school, 13% completed some college, and 15% made it to a bachelor's degree or higher. And due to the time, the percentage skews more male for completing more education. For the earlier silents especially, some would have gone to segregated schools. There was also a transition away from the one-room schoolhouse. Automobile technology is part of what changed schools. Because buses could now transport kids a farther distance, schools began to separate more. And so now we had high schools with a bunch of teenagers in one place, separated from the younger kids, which probably reinforced the youth culture, which I'll talk about in a bit. Education itself also allegedly changed, making it more practical and involving more fun / projects and things. On to work. In 1938, the U.S. passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which prohibited those under the age of 14 from working in most industries and put restrictions on hours and hazardous work. So most of the silents would have been protected under this, though it did not apply to farm work. The act also allowed workers to earn overtime if they worked more than 44 hours. Now, when they were all adults in 1963, the Equal Pay Act was passed to make it illegal to pay some workers less based solely on sex, though for the first decade, it did not apply to certain types of work either. There were other acts passed as well, all generally to make improvements to the workplace. When they became workers as adults, the companies often provided good benefits. Unions were strong during this time, but non-union companies would try and incentivize their employees by offering things so they would not unionize. Silents were typically loyal employees and expected that from their work as well. At least this is what is said. As you know, higher education wasn't common and wasn't frequently required. And also, by the time they entered the adult workforce, were pretty reliable, unemployment was low, and they could afford, it seems, to survive on one income. Women were to take care of the family, while men were to be in the workplace. Silents did see women enter the workforce, though, particularly in World War II, though they were then expected to return home. And those who did enter the workforce often saw the inequalities between both sex and race. So even when women were in the workplace, or racial minorities were in the workplace, they were often separate from the white man. Additionally, just the way it worked, promotions and salary increases tended to come with time at the company. So on a similar note, I also wanted to briefly talk about finances. This generation has sometimes been called the lucky few due to their timing, and a book had that name. That's part of where it comes from. Which, by the way, I said that, you know, they were also called the traditionalists, some used the veterans, etc., but usually no one is interested in those other names, so I'm not going to go into that more. Anyway, generational writer Neil Howe wrote an interesting and long article in Forbes about silence, which covers some financial topics regarding this generation. He talks about that idea about many of them getting lucky timing-wise. When they graduated high school, there was a good economy waiting for them, and they even had better earnings abilities at a young age than people who were older than them at times, than their parents. Plus, like I said, unemployment was low. Though, of course, again, we have to acknowledge that the opportunities were not 100% equal. Many got good interest rates on houses before inflation hit, and they also got defined pension plans. And then, due to their smaller size, things like Social Security and Medicare have been less of an issue. Plus, since most all by house birth years would have hit 65 by 2007, most had likely moved their investments to a more conservative state. He said cashed out, but I'm sure it varies. But it was quite an interesting article. But yeah, I want to mention, you know, individual circumstances play a role in it. And I mentioned this earlier, but just since we're on this topic, they did tend to be thrifty. And just another note, houses were much smaller back then. I saw a reference to the National Home Builders Association that said the average home in the 1950s was less than half the size of the average new home that was being built in 2019. Now I just wanted to touch on a few other fun cultural type topics like music and dance. While youth culture started a little earlier, the idea of teenagers actually didn't become more of a thing until around the 50s, at least how we think of it today. And the teenagers of the 50s would have been nearly all silent. So how did they enjoy that time? Some would have gone to the cinema or a sports game. Sports was becoming more popular, like sports things. This is when malls and shopping centers started to come about. Another activity I mentioned earlier was listening to the radio, and I also read about this thing where on Sundays, when things were shut down, they would dress up and go walk around town hoping to catch the eye of someone they were interested in. Now, music was a big part of this time too. Post-World War II was the beginning of rock and roll. The war was over and these kids were ready to have a good time. The jukebox was one way some young and probably old too people enjoyed enjoyed listening to music. During this time, white Americans also began to have more exposure to Black cultural influences. Some popular musicians included Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Frank Sinatra, and Elvis. The dance hall also grew in the 1940s. Live music and soft drinks were a part of this. Popular dances at this time included swing dancing, the twist, the boogie, the bop, the jitterbug, the bunny hop, and more. For being called the Silent Generation, it sure sounds like they were having a lot of fun dancing. The 1950s is also when the transistor radio came out, which was a new way to listen to music. When the hippie movement came along, it was a mix of silence and boomers. For example, if you look at the members of the Grateful Dead, they are a mix of late silence and early boomers.
Storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Brian Mendes. Oh, God, yeah. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. So today, I want to talk a little bit about what has happened in the world because the baby boomers have hung on to power a little bit too long. Now, I have to be clear here that I'm really talking about the earlier baby boomers, and I have to include the latter portion of the, maybe the latter half of the Depression, because it has really been a lot of folks born probably from 1937 to 1955-ish. I think even 55 is a little bit too far. So maybe ultimately the problem isn't mostly the baby boomers. Because I'm doing, you know, I hadn't really done the math in a minute. But there's a lot of people who are over the age of 70. So, you know, being in my 40s, I am becoming very aware of the constraints of time which occur to a person when they start to hit that more middle age range. The best years may be behind you, or they may be to come. But I really understand now that that pressure to make something of yourself in your late 30s into your 40s, which often causes crisis for people. So I want to acknowledge the fact that most people in their 20s do not appreciate how disheartening it is. Because I used to be one of them, so I get it. How disheartening it is to look back at your life and realize that though you may have accomplished some stuff, you haven't been able to do the things that you really wanted to do. And so you make a lot of grand stands to try to get there in your late 50s through your 60s. But at 70, I think there's a time when you have to start to be realistic about where you're at. And it probably should start as early as 65, but by 70, you have to be ready to backstep and to say, I'm going to be a mentor to a newer generation to get them to where they have to be so they can take over this planet. The problem with the last 30-plus years, 40-plus years of American history is there has been very little vision and action spent on preparing the succeeding generations to take power outside of the reactionary movements. The Democrats have been developing talent that'll compromise with the reactionary movement, that'll bow down to the reactionary movement, that'll see the reactionary movement as being the truth holders and tellers for this planet and for this country. They have not spent money or energy or time on developing a transgenerational infrastructure which would allow power, and not only power, but power is nothing without networks. Power is nothing without the system that enables it to not only spread outwards, but to reproduce itself. They have spent little time preparing a generation to take over for them when they finally moved off the scene. Instead, they have spent time playing around with power games. There is a, I think his name is Lawrence Wilkerson, who appears on Paul Jay's podcast often. Really great interviewer. I just wish the conversations were a bit longer. The man always has something brilliant to say. He worked for General Colin Powell, you know, history in the military complex, the military industrial complex. Now I believe he's a professor. He actually pointed this out a couple of years ago, that the Democrats have a succession of power problem. They have not done what the Republicans had. People may be angry at the freak show that the GOP has become, but you have to realize the reason they keep coming and coming and coming and coming and they're getting younger as they step forward is because for the last 40 years, well, really longer, the GOP has invested a significant amount of money into building transgenerational systems that ensure that, yes, the GOP may be older, the major supporters may be older, but there's going to be a young cadre there that's going to be able to step forward to fill up some of those ranks. Now, I do believe the young cadre is significantly less than the GOP had hoped, but they're still there. They're still there. To tell you how mainstream this plan has become, I want you to think about the fact that Liberty University, which is a fringe evangelical imperial college, plays its sports in Division I NCAA leagues. I was surprised to learn that. The Democrats have nothing comparative. People talk about how the colleges are a, you know, a cesspool. This is the right-wing talking point. The colleges are cesspools of liberal indoctrination. That's actually not true. Colleges have adopted neoliberal economic policies really from the top to the bottom. But that's, even if you look at the student body, it's not true. However, people tend to vote young, or when they're young, for things that their family needs. And the Republicans aren't talking about that. But I digress. I don't want to spend this hour, or however long this thing is going to end up being, slapping around the baby boomers, or even the New Deal. Well, I guess they wouldn't be in a New Deal, but the Great Depression generation. Those who are 70 really need to start stepping back and developing relationships with a younger generation and getting them moving forward. I feel bad for what's often called Generation X because their time in the sun has been seriously limited by the fact that the Great Depression generation wouldn't step aside earlier. Or the fact that because the Great Depression generation, and even, I don't even know what you'd call the between war generation, but even they wouldn't step aside that early. To say nothing about, you know, the people born World War I and directly afterwards, I mean, there has been this buildup over the last, you know, probably for about 40 or 50 years, from like 1920 to 1970, of political pressure to move the political process forward faster and to move aside one generation so another generation can step forward. And every time that has happened, the generation that was being asked to move aside has fought back bitterly, and sometimes for good reason. But at the same time, and the reason I say for good reason is because sometimes the younger members didn't understand as much as they should. And young people can be very exuberant, can be very, you know, energetic and what have you, but they also don't always listen. They don't always listen. And that's a problem. When there has been a sweeping change, like what happened when the Watergate scandal happened, it proved to be a blessing and a curse. And I don't know if we've seen that type of generational sweep happen since. Some people might say in 1994 when the Republicans took back the House, it was a kind of sense of that. But no, I don't believe even then it compares to what happened with the Watergate babies. I think in the next 10 years, we could see something like that in this country again. I think we could see something like that happen in this country again. The thing that concerns me is that just like with the Watergate babies, just like they didn't want to listen to any of the elders, I fear that many of the lessons learned by the previous generation are going to be ignored by the sweeping generation coming in. And I also fear that they will be forced to ignore the elders because the elders are going to be hostile, as Nancy Pelosi was to AOC and to the squad. They're going to be hostile to them because the elders are stuck in their ways and believe that these young kids are stupid and not only don't know nothing, but have to be stopped from making significant changes because they are so dumb and uninformed that they can't possibly know what the country needs. And you've seen that with Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi and the people, even Chuck Schumer, they all have this issue with young folks. Chuck Schumer seems to not have it as bad because he's in the Senate, and the Senate is a slow-moving body anyway. But definitely in the House of Representatives, there's this feeling that these young kids don't know nothing. And so, they've held up the progress that's needed. And what is really needed is for them to step aside and to act as mentors for these young people. But I fear we're not going to get that. So the collaboration that needs to happen won't happen. But this is supposed to be more than just me talking about these intergenerational conflicts. Now, note, I do use both intergenerational and transgenerational. And the reason I do that is not because I believe they're interchangeable. I don't. I wholeheartedly don't. I see the phrase intergenerational as different than transgenerational. And I don't even believe transgenerational is a technical word, but it should be. Intergenerational is the communication, the quote, interaction between generations, which may produce something. Transgenerational is the adopting of certain things and the handing off of certain things from one generation to another. It could be used in other ways, but that's how I'm using it for this show. So the idea behind this episode, obviously, is to talk about things that have happened because of the baby boomers and also the Great Depression generation have held on to power so long. The first item I have to talk about, I must speak about this, is being manifested by Joe Biden as I am speaking to you right now. And that is not understanding what the global politic needed from the United States at that time. Kennedy has always been seen as a person that was right for the time, even though his record, as it is unveiled more and more and more, suggests that he wasn't too opposed to doing some dastardly things to maintain U.S. Hegemony or to build U.S. hegemony at the time overseas. That includes killing or ordering the killing of heads of states and, you know, disrupting countries and all the stuff, because that's what the U.S. does. Frankly, the U.S. has rarely, if ever, had a president who actually fit what the globe needed at the time. Even Barack Obama, with all the hope that was lavished on him, didn't fit into what the globe needed at the time. Now, granted, he had a better grasp on where the world was at the present moment and seemed to have a vision that was far more compatible with the world than Clinton did or even Trump or many of the other people, you know? So we have to kind of give him the pass on that one, because the world seemed to really appreciate more than ever his style of international leadership more so than other people's. Now, what's funny is, quickly, Barack Obama is a good example as to why the Constitution was amended to stop popular presidents from being reelected a third time or a fourth time. Because Barack Obama, had he ran against Trump in 2016, he would have won. He would have beat Trump like a wild horse. But I apologize, I don't mean any disrespect to wild horses. I think they're magnificent and beautiful. But, you know, it's a horrible saying, so I apologize. But he would have beaten him. And he would have beaten him bad, which tells you the real motive behind that constitutional amendment. Big business was really in support of it. They did not want another FDR to rise. and obviously it stops Trump, but Trump got stopped by the people. So I digress. Joe Biden is not, and I don't even believe Kamala Harris is positioned well enough to comprehend what the world needs from the United States presently and to act on it. The sad part about it is I'm looking around at the, quote, leaders that have been developed in the Democratic Party, and I don't believe any of them just about right now have what it takes. Well, there may be a couple of them that dark horse will run in 2028 because it looks like Biden is going to run in 2024. For what reason, Lord knows, I don't know. But I don't know if any of them really has what it takes to be president and to have a full global vision as to what the world requires from the United States, which is frightening and sad, and frightening and sad altogether. So the second item I do want to talk about has to deal with changes within the society that need laws passed to actually either regulate it or to structure the society in a way that helps it flourish but limits its bad spots. We have seen time and time and time again that specifically when talking about internet stuff, digital stuff, and things that are just everyday life to most people under the age of 40, but most specifically people under the age of 30, when those issues are put forward to people in their 60s, in their 70s, who are in positions of power, most of them do not know what the hell they're talking about. They don't know the basic concepts associated with these things. And to the extent that they have to use them, it is just brazenly inadequate, their wisdom of this, of the stuff that they're using. And so when young people, here I'm talking in their 20s and early 30s, approach these older politicians about doing something about these issues, politicians typically don't have any idea what these young people are talking about. Not only do they not have an idea, but usually the people who they have to rely on explaining the problem to them, the people they have to rely on are lobbyists, who obviously will spin the problem in a way which makes, well, it seem like, oh, well, it's not really that big of an issue. These young people are just, you know, talking out of their behinds. It's not that big of an issue, when it could be a very huge issue. It could be a huge issue. And yet, because they're getting their information from the lobbyists and not from the people who are telling, who can explain it to them the best, which are the people on the ground, they are more likely to see it the way that the lobbyists want them to see it. Huge problem. Huge problem. We saw this with net neutrality. We saw it with conversations over the last 12, 15 years surrounding regulating telecom companies. We saw it with the GameStop quote controversy that occurred 2 years back now. Can't even believe that's been 2 years already. These folks jumped in on the side of Wall Street and the lobbyists. Why? Because it's not possible that the average American citizen understood much better than Congress and their lobbyist friends what the impact was and what was actually going down. They had pegged it, the people who had did this GameStop thing, they had pegged it correctly. They saw the trends. They saw that Wall Street was trying to basically bankrupt GameStop. And they said, hell no, we care about it too much. So we're flipping it on you. And when they flipped it on the lobbyists, when they flipped it on the Wall Streeters, when they flipped it on the people who were trying to destroy something they cared about, it was impossible for the people over the age, 50, 60, to see that these people were fighting back with the weapons that had been tossed at them all along. It was impossible to see that because these were just people online and nameless, faceless people who could be doing the country harm. Ooh! Forget the pictures people were posting saying, hey, because we did this, I was able to pay off this debt. I was able to do this. I was able to buy that. I was able to do things that I wasn't able to do before because we did what the wealthy do and get away with it all the time. But now you want to come down on us. There is a case before the Supreme Court, and I think it had to do with the internet. And the lawyer started to explain it to one of the old people on the Supreme Court, one of the conservatives, who was like, oh, it's all Greek and blah, blah. Well, he probably speaks Greek, so it's all Spanish to me, and I don't know about any of this, and I don't want to blah, blah, blah. Dude, you're getting ready to pass judgment on something that you don't know nothing about. You just said you know nothing about it, and yet you are going to tell me, as a citizen, that I need to take serious your ruling. Even though you just told me you not only know nothing about it, but you don't want to deal with it because it's too hard at your advanced age. Well, then you need to be off the bench, my man. You need to take your butt to a retirement home or wherever the hell else you want to go, and you need to go. Because if you're telling me that this is too hard for you and you don't want to deal with it because, you know, you might have to do some work and understand the current times that you were living in, then you were telling me that you're being lazy and you're derelict of your duties. You need to go. Of course, people ain't going to tell them that, but that's what needs to happen. The third point, and I think this is actually the most important point is, and it has less to do with the world than it does to do with the generation, itself. Because they've held on to power so long, the generation has not been able to learn the lessons from its victories and from its mistakes. So they have been unwilling to step back far enough to look at the tides in their own generational history and say, this is where we went wrong, this is where we went right, this is why, this is how, this is da-da-da-da-da. Here you go, next generation, learn from our mistakes. Moreover, because over the last 30 years, the book writing industry has become, well, I mean, it's always been flooded with stuff, but it's really become a marketplace of market forces. Because that has occurred, there was years ago, there was this great book that I listened to. This is a short book too. I think it was literally called The Marketplace of Ideas. And it talked about how the publishing world had evolved along with the academic world under neoliberal constructs and principles. It was a really, really fascinating book. One that really I haven't thought about probably since I listened to it, which I think was 2010 or 2011. But it was really, it was a fascinating, fascinating book. But because that has occurred with book publishing, it's harder to really nail down long-lasting, you know, lessons testamented books. There are so many books that have flooded the market in the last 30 years that the really, really, really indispensable ones, the valuable ones, get lost. I'll give you a great example of that. I'm confident this book was a had an influence on Chris Hedges when he first started to really lecture. Because I heard him make a couple of references, which I later heard Lewis Latham make in interviews that he gave back in the 1990s and in the mid-2010s. Now, for those of you who do not know who Lewis Lapham is, L-A-P-H-A-M, look him up, Lewis Lapham, L-A-P-H-A-M. He has a very long, distinguished career. Powerful reader, powerful man of history. He really does seem to grasp not only history, but the layers to history. But I watched a number of really great interviews by him way back in 2020 and was floored. I mean, he's one of those old school, I don't know if it's the right word, but I think it's the right word, patricianary types, who's very august in the way that he presents himself and the information that he dispenses. The man walks and talks like a living library. And because he was around power and understood power and how power evolved, he was able to speak, or should I say evolves, he was able to speak more plainly in complex language. I know that seems like it can't match, but he literally, I watched him do it multiple times. He speaks in ordinary complex language in a way that is understandable to the average person. And so he wrote a book, and I was having a very difficult time getting my hands on a book, on a copy of the book that wasn't going to set me back $100-something. And then a copy fell into my lap on eBay, and, you know, it was like for $20, and I was like, I don't care. $20 plus $6 for shipping or something like that. I grabbed it. The book title, and I wish he would put this back into print, The Wish for Kings, Democracy at Bay. This book was written, I believe, in the early 1990s. And, well, it pretty much tells a, it doesn't really, I can't say it tells a story, because it doesn't really tell a story. It speaks about, the problems of power and a seeming unintended addiction and slow pedal towards kingdomness and authoritarianness. And it's a fascinating little read. And it's a short book. And look, I haven't even read the whole thing. I read a few chapters of it when I first got it, put it on my shelf, and this is the first time I picked it up, which probably means sometime in the coming month or two, I'll read the rest of it, because it's really been on my mind lately. Now, a book that I also leafed through by him, and I was interested in a couple of the published articles that was published in the book, and I cannot find it. he put together a really good compilation of his works leading up to Donald Trump, and I can't believe I can't find it, but I did find it. Age of Folly, America Abandons Its Democracy. Now, mind you, The Wish for Kings came out 20 plus years prior. And that the subtitle to that was Democracy at Bay. This one, Age of Folly, America Abandons Its Democracy. And it is a collection of writings that Lewis Lapham had published in various newspapers, magazines, and possibly stuff that he published himself over the years. Basically plotting on a map all of the steps needed to suggest that America was in the process of abandoning its democracy. I loved the article so much, I kept this book on my desk for some time. It was just brilliant. So he's a really good writer. He's the publisher of the Lapham Quarterly, if I believe that's the title of it, Lapham. I am not getting paid by him to push you towards him. The man just, he appreciates great work. And while he is a very older gentleman, I'm kind of glad he's still working. because we need that. And we do need folks like him to prepare a newer generation at the same time. So, you know, I hope he's doing that. I really hope he's doing that. Because a lot of the problem, as I pointed out earlier, is that the baby boomer generation, the Great Depression generation, they are doing that. So, the fourth point here, and I may wrap up on this point, is something I call generational handicapping. And I've kind of alluded to it before. But I really want to kind of get into it a little bit right now because it kind of plays into every single point that I've mentioned thus far. The idea behind generational handicapping comes back to the idea of, and I haven't obviously talked about this today, but comes back to the idea of competition. In a society that is hyperly competitive, that is supposedly individualistic and competitive, what it does is it creates the place for atomization. And while we think of atomization as a person-to-person problem, that's not how the human mind works. Humanity, the human being, even when ill-developed, is a naturally social being. Very few of them want to be alone completely. Because of this, when you live in a atomized, hyper-competitive, individualistic state or place, what occurs is not just that you could feel isolated, but when you're in your groups, when you're in your cliques, that is the clique or the group that that group or clique is a unit and acts as one individual against another clique or unit, which also acts as an individual. That could present itself in many ways in a society, especially when you start getting, quote, you know, the idea of cross-pollinization with networks. So one network's people could mostly belong to, let's say, a corporation. And then another network's people can belong to another corporation. And so those networks themselves could be having problems, and all those problems dissolve when they go against another network. Okay? So the same thing can happen with families. So families can be beefing with other families because one family is problematic to another family and the other family is problematic to that family. You create this situation where individuality can also take place at a unit level, a group level, or even a generational level. This is where generational handicapping comes in. I've mentioned on the show before, the baby boomer generation was the recipient of the greatest wealth transfer to ever occur on this planet. Not this country, or in this country, or in the past 600 years or something like that. No, it is to ever occur on this planet throughout the history of humanity. The baby boomers received the greatest wealth transfer ever. Now, the only generation that might displace them is the British generation, that was born prior to World War II. And really, I guess, technically, they would be... Yeah, maybe a little bit earlier than World War II, maybe around World War I, because they were given the British Empire, and that was a huge empire. So maybe. But I still believe it was greater for the baby boomer generation. And I'm talking not just the United States, I'm talking globally, particularly in what they call first world countries. So one generation believing that itself is, how do I want to phrase this? I know how to do this. One generation, having been given so much, you know, you look at this as family dynamics. So one generation, having been given so much, could go one of two ways with it. They can be a sharer because they've been given so much abundance, so they can want to share it with the next generation or the next sibling. And they can set up a really good foundation for passing it along to siblings to come. Or they can say, no, it's mine. And they can do everything they can to hoard it for themselves. You know, it's the quandary that some rich families face and don't do a good job of actually dealing with. You get one kid that gets everything and then doesn't want to give anything to the other siblings, or makes it difficult for them to feel comfortable in what they do get. This happened with the baby boomer generation. They were tied up in themselves, so much so that either one, their parents didn't try to tell them what actually went into creating the world that they were receiving, or two, they didn't listen anyway. And knowing a lot of baby boomers, I'm going to imagine a lot of them just didn't listen. And to be honest with you, I'm also going to imagine that a lot of parents just didn't tell them. Yeah, it's both of them. It's both are true, I think. So, because they didn't have that knowledge, and I remember there was a speech that Dr. King gave, part of his Massey lecture, M-A-S-S-E-Y lecture series, where he talked about the youth. And to be honest with you, he wasn't talking mostly about black youth. He was talking about white youth, which I thought was quite interesting. Dr. King was still trying to explain to white people their own youth, because white people were not listening to their own youth. I mean, think about how crazy that is. Martin Luther King, Mr. Black Civil Rights Are Everything, were trying to get white parents to understand where their young white children stood because their parents did not want to listen to them, which is probably why today a lot of parents and even some grandparents who would have been those children in the 1960s, those teenagers and young adults in the 1960s and 1970s, maybe that might be why a lot of those parents are quick to listen to their children when their children today are saying, things are really messed up, we need to change stuff. Or why their grandparents are listening to them. Many parents wanted their kids in that time to fly straight and narrow, get a good paying job, have a family, and, you know, basically repeat, rinse, repeat, and blah, 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 right? Wash, rinse, repeat. There we go. And a lot of their young, you know, a lot of young people were like, no, there's real big problems we have to solve, and I need you to allow me to do that. And the parents fought them on that. And it seemed to be almost a punishment in the 70s and 80s, where the parental generation said, we're taking everything back because you didn't listen to us. Now, to be fair and honest, I can't blame the baby boomers for the 1980s. Well, I could blame the baby boomers. Yeah, I can blame the baby boomers for the 1980s. But I don't know what I don't want to pretend to act like I know what the voting percentage was for baby boomers back then. The Great Depression generation may have been trying to punish, in the 70s at least, the baby boomer generation, and that spilled over into the 80s. So, either way, the baby boomer generation went on this track for the next 40 years. I was going to exclude the 80s, but I'll keep the 80s in there. So 40 years of depriving the next generation of what they received, what they were bequeathed, what they were given. Not only did they work to deprive that generation of what they were given, they worked extra hard, it seems, to overturn the network, the systems, the laws that made it possible for not only them to accept what they were bequeathed, but also to utilize what they were given to make their lives better. It was as if they were literally going around and just cutting up the wires and pipes and the walls of the house that they had been given so that their siblings wouldn't be able to take it over. And in this way, every single thing that they did, they were handicapping the next generation. I mean, I honest to God think ultimately that was the goal, was from a competitive standpoint, they knocked the legs out from under the next generation. And this includes, by the way, Generation X, the millennials, and they've tried to do it with Generation Z, but Generation Z is fighting back. Just so that they could, I don't even know, I would say hold the title of the most favored generation or something, because, you know, Tom Brokaw called the generation before them the greatest generation. I don't believe in that, because they literally let fascism rise. Yes, they fought for it, but when they didn't learn the lessons which they were fighting, you know, which came from that fight, they literally, from the United States, went over to defeat the Nazis and then came home and was like, oh yeah, by the way, but we're still going to be a bunch of racists. And we're still going to run a terror state, multiple terror states in the South, including in Texas, including in Mississippi, including in areas of Louisiana, if not Louisiana altogether. They were literally running terror states after going over and defeating the Nazis. A feat, by the way, that was only made possible by black folks in this country fighting en masse alongside them. A feat that we don't necessarily get the credit for. That's why I don't call them the greatest generation, and never will. I digress, though. There is a fight still to this day against the future and against the coming generations. At present, if you look at what a lot of neoconservatives are saying, if you look at what a lot of evangelical conservatives are saying and what they're doing, all of them are fighting against the future. though they talk about being pro-life, they want, you know, women to have babies and stuff like that, they don't want to build a society which sustains those kids, which nourishes and helps to raise those kids. They just want babies. And I'm not going to say any more on that, because if I do, then it's going to be another half hour on that stuff. So I'm going to get away from there. The point of this whole thing, though, and I could add some more, and maybe later on I'll do a part two to this, is to just look at a few problems, you know, of the impact of this generation holding on to too much power. And it's something I think we need to take serious. Because over the coming 10 years, there is going to be a power shift. The only problem is now, you have three generations that are going to be fighting over what the baby boomers are leaving behind. It's possible that we don't fight. It's possible that we're able to come to consensus and agreement so we can make better the world which they are handing over to us. Rather, they do it willingly, or we have to literally pry it from their cold, dead hands. Don't hurt the elderly, guys. Please don't, okay? But it's absolutely possible that as they're dying away, they literally cling to the earth and won't let it go until, you know, we literally have to peel their fingers off of it after they've died and say, now we can take care of the stuff that they wouldn't let us while they were living. Let's go. But we'll have to wait and see if that happens. I'm hoping we are mature enough to be able to do what we need to do to make the world better and not have to really fight generationally over the levers of power. I know conservatives are hoping to do that. They're pushing all the buttons to make sure it happens, but I think we could rise above that. Thank you all for listening. Sorry about how my voice got towards the end. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. You know that. Show ideas, by the way. Send them to me. Oh, and if you find any great articles or journal articles or anything like that, send them to me. For those of you who do not know, you can send them to me on Facebook. Class War Battlefield Podcast actually has a Facebook page. You can hit me up on Facebook. You can hit me up at radioforall.net. There's a tab that allows you to contact the contributor. Just click the tab, write your statement, and it'll send it right to me. You don't have to worry about email address or nothing. You could just go right over to radio, the number 4, all.net. Radio, the number 4, all.net. And then just click into one of the shows, and then contact contributor, write your message, and it'll get sent to me. If you like what I'm doing here, please support what I'm doing here. Help keep CWB podcast alive. 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, however much you can give every month, y'all. It is much appreciated. You can hit me up on PayPal. You can hit me up on Cash App. And if you're having problems, please let me know, because I was hoping those problems were fixed. So, until the next one, family. I'm your brother, Vimera Diesel. Gaia. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lies in the balance.